The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, thank you. There will be an interruption at some point because there's a page out of my notes that's being photocopied that I want to distribute when I get to that point. So, Westminster Theological Seminary and Presbyterian Theological Education. Here we go.
That was quick. Thank you.
I'll hold on to these for now. We'll distribute those later. I do not know about you, but when I am sitting in the examination room waiting for my doctor to come and diagnose my illness, I read the degrees, certificates, and awards decorating the walls. I want to see where my doctor went to medical school, whether he has his certification from the state board, whether he's a member of any professional organizations, whether he's been honored for his competency, and I want to know that he has served his internship in the appropriate fields of specialization. When I go to the doctor, I want to know that my doctor is educated and qualified to interview me about my symptoms, come to a thoughtful diagnosis, and propose the best treatment. When I go to the doctor, I want an expert, a scholar, a physician that knows medicine. I want the best doctor I can get. The Puritans used to describe a pastor as a, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this correctly, chirurgian of the soul, where chirurgian is an earlier form of our modern word, surgeon. That is, one of the minister's responsibilities is to weigh a person's symptoms, come up with a spiritual diagnosis, and propose the best treatment. In some cases, a minister listens to the symptoms and draws the conclusion that the one with whom he is conversing is not a Christian, which means that he must present the grace of the gospel and confront the counselee with the need for salvation. In other cases, it is realized that the counselee bears all the marks of a true and living faith, and the person must be taught from the word to cope with the loss of a loved one or handle some issue that is particularly vexing. When the minister is leading the congregation in worship, he must speak to both groups in the congregation, those who are members of the church and those who are not. The scalpel of the word must be brought to bear in a precise and forthright manner, and then the suturing verses of the Bible must be sown with care and compassion. The minister must be thoroughly equipped to present the word of God according to sound doctrine in language that is straightforward and clear to his listeners. Ministers should be knowledgeable people, and the congregation should expect their pastors to be educated. Now, admittedly, it would be quite tacky as you exit a church you were visiting to shake the preacher's hand at the door and ask, "Well, Pastor, would you tell me about your education, certification, achievements, and evangelistic experience?" No, that would not be very polite, would it? However, denominationally attached Presbyterian churches enjoy the benefit of a connectional church government and the assurance that the pastor has been examined by the presbytery. Most of one's curiosity about a minister's suitability for ministry has been alleviated by the plurality of elders examining him in the presbytery. So a question is, why is it that people are sometimes not as concerned about the education of the physicians of their souls as they are about the training of the physicians of their bodies? Why is it that when a pastor stands at the door following a sermon in which he has as faithfully as possible expressed what the Bible has to say about some issue, some in the congregation shake his hand as they leave, smile and say, "Preacher, that is your opinion." Do you say to your physician as you shake his hand after he has made his diagnosis of your sickness, "Well, doctor, that is your opinion"? Of course, you might get a second opinion if the disease is a particularly severe one, but most of the time when the doctor presents his diagnosis, we weigh what he says and think about how we can contribute to curing the illness by taking any pharmaceuticals he has prescribed or any changes in our lifestyle that would help us with the disease. Generally, we go to the doctor because we want to hear what we need to do to cure our sicknesses. We go to physicians because we value their educated opinion. However, do we hold a minister's analysis of a spiritual malady with the same respect we might a physician's diagnosis? With it in mind that a pastor is a physician or surgeon of the soul, we need to look briefly at the development of ministerial education in the Presbyterian Church in the British colonies of America, and then its further development after the colonies became that dreaded independent nation that we heard about this morning. I have to say that Dr. Whitmer's lecture covered the things that I am not going to, so this is great. But the beginning of American Presbyterian theological education, Presbyterianism was established by Francis McKimmy and a handful of early 18th century immigrant Presbyterian ministers in the American British colonies. The early Presbyterian church suffered and struggled and had difficulty providing enough ministers to serve its often scattered congregations. Sometimes those early pastors spent more time in the saddle than serving their geographically scattered flocks. Reminds me of James Moore in the Westminster Lives book. He told me once that he spent more time praying over his car than he did his congregation. It gives an idea of his income, I guess, and the car that he had. As the Presbyterian Church spread into more remote areas of the colonies, the need for qualified pastors increased. Somehow, young men needed to be theologically trained with a consistently unified education, and following the Adopting Act in 1729, a particularly confessional education. Early ministerial candidates in the colonies would sometimes attend college in Scotland, Ireland, or New England, Harvard, Yale, as Dr. Whitmer mentioned, return to their homes and be tutored in theology by a local pastor. It was unusual for a man to be tutored in theology without having some kind of college education. This tutoring method provided the candidate with a theological education, but the quality of that education was very much dependent on the abilities of his mentor and any prejudices the mentor might have concerning what should or should not be taught. However, one of the advantages of this early means of training was that the young ministerial aspirant in many cases lived with his mentor. He saw day in and day out what it was like to be a minister, so that he was tutored not only by word but deed as well. The inconsistency of content and questions regarding the tutor's doctrinal commitment were substantial problems, and the Presbyterians knew that a better educational system needed to be found. Moving from the personal tutoring mode to a more classroom-oriented approach was, as Dr. Whitmer mentioned, the Log College of the Tenants. Archibald Alexander's book, The Log College, published in 1851, tells us something about the college, but most of Alexander's content contains biographies of the graduates and views the college as its graduates from the graduates of the college from the perspective of their participation in revivals. If you dare to risk your life and stand on the edge of Highway 263 at the edge of the property of the Christ Home for Children in Neshaminy, you can read the Log College Memorial that has been erected there by the Presbyterian Historical Society. It fixes the date of the start of the Log College at 1727 and lists 63 colleges and universities that were founded through the ministries of William Tennant and the other Tennants and students from the Log College. The first institution listed is Princeton University, which was founded as the College of New Jersey and might be considered the direct descendant of the Log College. Other institutions mentioned include Hampton Sidney, Davidson, Lafayette, Grove City, Agnes Scott, Hanover, and Queens. There are also some colleges mentioned that have become major public universities. This is something I don't think Americans realize, is that much of the groundwork and foundations of American education was laid by Presbyterian ministers because they were educated and they were the ones who could teach. So even though there was a more defined classroom approach to ministerial education in the Log College, it could also be seen as a tutorial situation with multiple students being instructed. The revival perspective of Tennant influenced his students and is an example of how in the tutoring situation One's personal perspective can cause an overemphasis in one area or another. The Tenants Log College could have benefited from less emphasis on the quick fix thinking of revivalism and more teaching on the persistent and long-term ministry of the pastor to his local congregation as the means to communicate the gospel and encourage his flock and evangelize his area. As the years passed, it increasingly became obvious that the inconsistency of the quality of ministerial education for Presbyterian pastors was problematic. The General Assembly came to address the issue by opening its first seminary in the wonderful little village, at least I think so, of Princeton, New Jersey. The push for the seminary began at the 1809 General Assembly with an overture from the Presbytery of Philadelphia. The report of the committee presented three possible resolutions to the seminary issue in terms of geographical locations. First, that the seminary be located near the geographical center of the bounds of the church. A second proposal was to establish two schools to serve the northern and southern divisions of the church. And a third proposal was that they would establish a school in each of the synods, where a synod is a group of presbyteries. For example, there was a synod of Virginia, a synod of North Carolina. After seeking the advice of the presbyteries and considerable debate, the single seminary was victorious, and it was, quote, resolved that Princeton be the site of the theological seminary, leaving the subject open as to its permanency, agreeably to the stipulation agreed upon by the joint committee of the last assembly and the trustees of the College of New Jersey, end quote. The college provided the land for seminary buildings, and the college allowed the seminary to use its buildings until the buildings for the seminary were completed. I thought it was interesting that they selected it as the temporary location, but they were already planning to build buildings. So, a little political maneuvering there, I think, in the General Assembly. The theological seminary founded at Princeton was established to provide more ministers to fill the shortage as the national population expanded. The seminary's responsibility was, according to the plan of the seminary, as developed by the General Assembly, to educate students to, quote, be more thoroughly furnished than they have ordinarily been for the arduous work to which they must be called, and provide them with an education in the doctrinal system, or for Carl Truman, doctrinal system, set forth in the Confession of Faith, Catechisms, and Plan of Government and Discipline of the Presbyterian Church, and thus to perpetuate and extend the influence of true evangelical piety and gospel order, end quote. The plan goes on to say of the educational program that, quote, it is to provide for the church an adequate supply and succession of able and faithful ministers of the New Testament, workmen that need not be ashamed, being qualified rightly to divide the word of truth, end quote. Another interesting part of the original plan of the seminary was that it provided a free education for the students. Of course, the reason that Princeton students could enjoy free education was because the seminary was owned and operated by the Presbyterian Church. When Presbyterian students were sent by their presbyteries to Princeton, there was a connectional relationship and financing by the denomination. Dr. Machen continued free tuition when he founded Westminster, but as the years passed, it became necessary to require fees. In our 21st century context, we find that many of the Reformed seminaries, including Westminster, are not operated by a Presbyterian or Reformed denomination and obtain their funding from a combination of student tuition, gifts from churches, and donated from those who are interested in the seminary. Independent seminaries compensate for the lack of denominational affinity with boards constituted of members, as here at Westminster, who represent the different denominations the seminary's curriculum is designed primarily to serve. I'd like to look at again, Dr. Weber mentioned Samuel Miller. I'll go to Samuel Miller, a lecture that he delivered. In July of 1829, they had summer sessions at Princeton. I know the faculty here would probably hate the thought of having summer sessions. There's so much work to do left over from the academic year. But they had summer sessions. His lecture was titled The Importance of Mature Preparatory Study for the Ministry. It is available in the digital collection of the Luce Archives at Princeton Seminary. You can download it and print it out if you want to. Dr. Miller, who became the second faculty member at the seminary, joined Archibald Alexander, he made several points regarding the importance of proper preparation of the ministry. One point he made is that a minister, as any Christian, should serve Christ with the best he has to offer. This preparation includes a Holy Spirit-directed and pious life that is thoroughly instructed in the things of the kingdom of God and mighty in the Scriptures. In Dr. Machen's words, 100 years later, the students were to be trained to be experts in the Bible. Another point Dr. Miller presented is that a minister needs to be educated thoroughly because of the importance and difficulty of the various departments necessary for ministerial education. The faculty and curriculum were to provide a ministerial education that was as comprehensive as possible with respect to the Bible, theology, piety, the church, and its history. The physician of souls needs to know how to interpret and apply the Bible, understand the historical context of Scripture's composition, learn from its use throughout the history of the church, be capable of defending the faith, and know the secondary constitutional standards of the church. A third issue raised by Dr. Miller is that, quote, he who does not lay a good foundation in the beginning will never be likely to supply the deficiency afterwards, end quote. As today, the urgency that a ministerial candidate might have felt in Miller's day sometimes led the candidate to accept a minimal education. They had a problem at Princeton with people going to the seminary for maybe a year and then going off and say they'd been to seminary. You've got to remember, communication was not very good back then. And they give the impression they were Princeton graduates. Zeal for the gospel is a good thing, but zeal must be tempered with knowledge and wisdom if it is to be properly channeled for an effective ministry. An aspect of a good residential seminary education that Dr. Miller brings out is that it establishes the discipline needed not only for study, but for the other daily ministerial duties of the pastorate. That is, good discipline in study provides for a disciplined life in other areas. And the last of the points I have selected from Dr. Miller's several points in his discourse returns to the Puritans' description of pastors as chirurgeons of the soul. He contended that what America needed was a larger supply of truly able, pious, and well-trained ministers of the gospel. That is, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. However, despite the urgency of the situation, as Dr. Miller perceived it, he said, quote, suppose a population of 10,000 families to be laboring under a contagious and mortal disease. Would it be better to send among them half a dozen wise and skillful physicians, or 50, or even 100 miserable quacks? You see, these old Presbyterians had a good sense of humor. Who would be likely to kill more than they would cure? Surely no thinking man can hesitate a moment about the proper answer. The truth is, there are enough unqualified men in the ministry as it is, end quote. Miller then goes on to say that in his era, the Presbyterian Church might have been better off with half the ministers it had if that half remaining was better educated and properly prepared for pastoral ministry. Similar sentiments are expressed in the South by George Howe just 7 years after Dr. Miller's 1829 discourse, as he delivered an address to the Synod of South Carolina in Georgia that implored men to enter the ministry because of the shortage of qualified ministers. In both cases, in the North with Dr. Miller, and in the South with Dr. Howe, the concern was not for ministers, just any old minister, but qualified ministers. Some might think that what Dr. Miller says is harsh and insensitive to the sometimes unusual circumstances faced by some ministerial candidates. However, Dr. Miller comments that due to health, age, or some unique workings of God's providence, some candidates simply cannot be as fully educated as they should. But this is the unusual case and not the usual. In some Presbyterian forms of government, there is a clause concerning the Presbytery's option for reducing the theological education of those candidates with extraordinary reasons limiting their ability to fulfill all the requirements. Though this clause may sometimes be overused by Presbyteries, it does provide an opportunity for ministerial candidates with unusual circumstances to be ordained with less than the normal educational requirements. The goal, says Dr. Miller, of ministerial education is not, quote, a cold and heartless erudition in the gospel ministry, to which he adds that an unfeigned piety is no doubt the most essential qualification, the most precious and glorious ornament of the ministerial character. Though a minister have all the learning in the world, yet if he were a stranger to the converting and sanctifying grace of God, there would be no reason to expect him to prove a blessing to the church, end quote, which I think is a superb quote. With Dr. Miller's thoughts in mind and the original plan for Princeton Seminary guiding the program over the years, the Presbyterian Church continued to educate its ministers through a three-year program of study. In the early years, there was some debate about reducing education to 2 years, but that was not accomplished, fortunately. Following the founding of Princeton, other seminaries were established, such as Union in Virginia in 1812, Columbia in South Carolina in 1828, McCormick in 1830, San Francisco in 1871, Austin in 1884, and Omaha in 1891. Sometimes following the roots of a seminary is not easy. For example, Union in Virginia traces its classes back to 1806 or 1807, but it formally became a seminary of the Synod of Virginia in 1812. In the case of McCormick Seminary, it was founded in 1830 as the Theological Department of Hanover College in Hanover, Indiana. Then, in 1840, it became the New Albany Theological Seminary in New Albany, Alabama, Indiana. And then in 1859, it moved to Chicago and became the Presbyterian Theological Seminary of the Northwest. And finally, in 1886, it was named McCormick Theological Seminary for Cyrus McCormick, who invented a wheat reaping machine in 1831. And I point out that is a wheat reaping machine and not a soul reaping machine, even though he had a seminary named for him. However, the point is that Presbyterians continued to provide theological education for their clergy and increased their campuses as the nation expanded westward to the Pacific. Now I'd like to take a jump to Westminster. With this background of theological education in mind, I'd like to transition to Westminster Seminary. With the reorganization of Princeton Seminary and due to the increasing conflict faced by Dr. Machen, Westminster was founded in the fall of 1929. It had only been a few months since Dr. Machen left Princeton when classes convened. A look at the available information in the seminary archives shows that organizing the seminary was a hurried business. A preliminary flyer was hastily printed to advertise the new seminary's curriculum until a regular catalog was completed for the 1929-30 academic year. What was Westminster like when it first opened on its Pine Street campus in 1929? I'd like to go through Westminster's first catalog and look at some items of interest and compare the divinity curriculum of that first year to the current curriculum. Included in the catalog is a listing of the colleges from which the 50 entering students had graduated. The top three colleges were Wheaton College with 7 graduates, Asbury College with 5 graduates, and both the University of Pennsylvania and Taylor University each had 4, while Princeton University and Hope College each had 3. The 7 students from Wheaton are not particularly surprising, but if you know anything about Asbury College, you know that it's contributing 10% of the entering student body to Westminster seems a bit unusual. Asbury College was originally named Kentucky Holiness College, which is even more unusual, but was named to honor the itinerant Methodist bishop and missionary Francis Asbury. Currently, Asbury College's religious commitment is described, quote, as bound by its bylaws to those doctrinal standards established by John Wesley and his immediate successors, end quote. So you see, Asbury's a bit unusual. So some of Asbury College's graduates who were in the opening classes of Westminster were leaving their Holiness Wesleyan Methodist Arminian College to attend Princeton and then Westminster, even though in 1923, Asbury had opened an on-campus theological seminary of its own. Not only were the Methodists from Asbury, but according to the Methodist League for Faith and Life's publication, The Essentialists, fully one-fourth of the original student body of Westminster was Methodist. In this article titled Methodists Among the Princeton Secession, the reporter, Harold J. Ockinga, who was a member of the first senior class at Westminster, interviewed some of the Methodist divinity students and quoted one student as saying, quote, I chose Princeton because of its clear-cut teaching concerning the Word of God and its aggregation of splendid scholars who honor God's truth. I found that there was no seminary like that in Methodism, so I waived denominational lines. When Princeton's foundations became shaky and her position wrapped in a haze of fog, God led me to a seminary about which there is no question, and now I thank God that He led me here. End quote. The Methodist students were concerned that they receive an education, as Dr. Machen put it, which would train them to be experts in the Bible. Now, if we could, I think we have probably, there's two dozen, somebody might need to share. I have a table on here I'd like to look at. I want to look at the curriculum for the first catalog and compare it to the curriculum for the 2008 and 2009 catalog. Uh-oh, I think I gave you my copy. No, here it is. Okay, I'm off. This table provides a comparison for the... This table provides a comparison of the distribution of hours of study necessary for completing the divinity degree in the First Westminster Seminary catalog and the current catalog. The total hours of the program do not include the biblical language requirements in either catalog. In 1929, as now, one's language requirements were based on assessing the entering student's language knowledge and contouring the classwork accordingly. Though the quality of the curriculum may not necessarily be adequately expressed by a statistical comparison, I think they show something about where Westminster has been and where it is currently with regards to its requirements. Note the following. I just want to point out a few things. The elective hours, which is EL, that's not English language, it's EL. The elective hours available to divinity students have dropped from 13 to 6, which is a loss of 46%. The greatest departmental gains in hours are in the systematics and practical departments. Systematics has gained 6 hours, going from 11 to 17, while practical has gained 5 hours, going from 16 to 21, which is a gain of 31%. The New Testament department gained 3 hours of curriculum, but Old Testament has lost 2 hours. In the original catalog, 53% of the biblical study hours were in Old Testament. In the current catalog, 45% are. The total hours dedicated to biblical studies, Old Testament and New Testament departments together, has only dropped by 1 hour, and about one-third of the total hours is dedicated to biblical study. Currently, both the church history and AP departments have exactly the same number of hours that they had in the original catalog. The total number of hours for the MDiv, not including the biblical languages, has increased from 87 to 92. The biggest loser of hours percentage-wise is the elective hours, having lost 7 hours, or 46% of its hours in the 29 catalog. It is interesting that in the original catalog, the PT department was tied with the OT department for the most number of hours, with 16 each. I mention this because I think the general perception is that Westminster has become more practical, theologically oriented since its early years, and quite honestly, when I saw this, I was surprised. I think I'm going to make a summary at this point. There, I compared the catalogs, the alumni catalog, the alumni for the first decade of the seminary, 1930 to 1939, to the alumni in the 2006 alumni catalog, and I've drawn some conclusions. Early on, as Dr. Whitmer pointed out, Westminster was primarily a place to train pastors. About 70% of the graduates in the 1930s were pastors. They described themselves that way in the alumni catalog. And as near as I can tell, there's a lot of apple and oranges comparison problems here. But as near as I can tell, it's about 50 to 55% now, and about 15 to 20% are going into educational fields. And again, part of the problem is the ministers in the 30s might have considered themselves ministers where they were primarily hospital chaplains and counselors. Today they might call themselves counselors. But I think there's a shift. And I see there are three emphases, and I had to adjust this since last night because there were so many counseling majors. The main emphasis is the pastor. I think the secondary emphasis is theological education and education in general, colleges, so forth. And the third is definitely counseling. And maybe the fourth is Nigeria. Three PhDs going to Nigeria. Great. And so I think the faculty and administration knows this, but there's a tremendous influence of Westminster through teachers teaching teachers and pastors all over the world. The influence, I don't think, can be measured. Just look at the example of what we saw about Nigeria. Enjove, I don't know if I pronounce his name correctly, Henneka is in Nigeria and has been there for many years and working with the Reformed Church there. But I would like to take a bit of an aside, and I will try to do it as quickly as possible, and tell about something that is important to me, and that is campus ministry. Most college ministry that we see today is through campus ministries that, to some degree, operate within a local church, but their attachment generally is to a more dedicated ministry, such as the PCA's Reformed University Ministries. I remember at one point I was candidating in a church in a college town that was dominated by the college faculty, so forth. And I said, well, what does the church do in relation to the college? And my interview was over. And I found out later that they thought the preacher spent way too much time at the college. So college ministry can be a difficult thing to do. But if you think about Luther and Calvin and the debates that took place in their time, I think the ministry is very important. I think a good example of this, when I went to college, there were about 30 people in my college Sunday school class. When I went back after my first freshman semester, there were about 8. Of course, some were involved in their new homes. Some were doing other things. But I think it's a very common problem that people abandon the church when they go to college. The assault on Orthodox Christianity is a way of life for professors and administrators in higher education. It takes a strong freshman to survive the hostile intellectual thrashing given by atheist faculty in the state and private universities. A friend of mine commented to me once that when he entered his freshman science class at a large state university, the professor took a Bible, threw it against the back wall, and said, "If you believe this, then you might as well get out now, because you will not make it through my class." So many covenant children are lost as they go to be educated in the temples of Baal. Thus, the importance of pastors and ministries that work in college towns is great. Maybe some reflection regarding the current Westminster curriculum by the seminary faculty and administration might show some ways that college town pastors and campus ministers might be helped in their preparation for the extremely difficult work on college campuses and in college communities. Maybe this could be facilitated with a few special classes and returning some of those lost elective hours to divinity students to contour their programs for campus ministry. Concluding thoughts. Returning to the comments made earlier regarding the first student body being about 1/4 Methodist, I would like to make some observations about the ministry of Westminster today. On the theological spectrum of evangelical churches, Methodism might be considered the opposite of Reformed theology. After all, Wesley and current evangelical Methodists are proponents of Arminianism. Then when one considers that 5 of those Methodists were from the Wesleyan Holiness Methodist Arminian College of Asbury, it seems particularly unusual that this mass of Methodists would choose Westminster, and I use mass in a relative sense. It may be that the uniting of the Welsh Calvinistic Methodists with the PCUSA in 1920 contributed to these more soteriologically Calvinistic Methodists entering Westminster. but maybe, maybe not. In the first student body at Westminster, the article in the Methodist newspaper that I quoted from earlier mentioned that the Methodists went first to Princeton Seminary and then with Dr. Machen to Westminster because they wanted to be taught about the Bible by professors that believe the Bible. In the seminary's 80th anniversary book, the book I have been mispronouncing as Westminster Lives, is actually Westminster Lives, Andre Sue said that she went to Westminster to learn about the Bible. John Galbraith went to Westminster because he knew the faculty and teaching would respect the Bible as the Word of God. Despite the fact that Westminster faculty teach from the perspective of the Westminster Standards, I would venture to say that most students entering the seminary enroll to learn about the Bible, and that those who want to learn about the Bible as interpreted by the Westminster Standards are a small number. There may be several reasons for this, but I think the major one is the anti-confessional atmosphere of not only contemporary evangelicalism, but contemporary gospel-believing Presbyterianism as well. Dr. Machen wanted Westminster to be a place where experts in the Bible could be educated from the confessional perspective of the Westminster Assembly's confession and catechisms. If Westminster wants to be appealing to contemporary evangelical and Reformed Christians as a seminary, then its faculty members need to be the best at training specialists in the Bible according to the doctrines taught by the confession and catechisms. Finally, my hope is that Westminster Seminary, Philadelphia, will continue for many years to prepare pastors who are true chirurgeons of the soul, equip teachers and academics for their educational ministries, and prepare confessionally literate experts in the Bible in the many other areas of ministry that the alumni have entered, both in America and worldwide. Thank you.
We have a few minutes left, so I'm going to throw it open for questions. If anybody has any questions for Barry, just got 5 minutes before the close.
Great.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm not going to let you.
Okay.
I was struck by, if I have it right, at the founding of Princeton. Here's the quote I think that you wrote down. In order to have a more thoroughly trained ministry than it had ordinarily been. Is that an implied criticism of the resident, that is the seminarians in the residency of the pastor? Forget the category that that Tim used in the way he was.
There was, you see, I think sometimes when historians look at the early years of not only Presbyterianism but any of the colonial churches, you forget what an extremely difficult situation it was. America was geographically just growing by leaps and bounds. And so there was all this territory to cover. And there was this tendency to let sort of this tyranny of the urgent get a hold of everything. And, well, here's this guy over from Scotland. He says he's ordained. You know, let's send him out to Western Ohio or whatever, you know, that type of thing. Probably Eastern Ohio at that time, or Western Pennsylvania at that time. And there are cases in the minutes of ministers who have been charlatans. They just lied. They were not educated and so forth. And then when you add to that, as I said, the prejudices about what should be taught. I mean, you know, if a guy thinks, you know, if his whole life revolves around a particular biblical issue and he's teaching other students, that's what he's going to emphasize. So the goal of the seminary was, you have these departments, or whatever you want to call them, broken down to address the appropriate areas, you know, to come up with some kind of unified curriculum where everybody's pretty much getting the same thing. And the seminary, yes, that was the solution. People today, a lot of people would say that's not a good solution. I think it's the best solution. Anything else? You have anything, Mr. Kushke? Our eldest alumni, I believe, here. Mr. Galbraith has recently had bypass surgery, John Galbraith, and he's not doing too well. I'm sorry, he was in church Sunday.
Right.
Pardon?
He's all right.
Okay. So, I guess that's it. That was an easy one, too.